Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Welcome to Insert Here, a sex podcast where lust and learning meet. I'm your host, Kate Warren. Each week, I invite a new guest on the show to share their experiences outside the heteronormative or vanilla worlds of sexual expression. Guests bring a wide variety of gender, orientation, and racial experiences to life through their stories. They approach sexuality in fascinating ways and talk about how it's informed by who they are and what they've experienced. I invite regular people to share their best tools, tips, and tricks for communicating, thinking about, and of course, having great sex. Today, our guest is Juan Pablo Ruiz. He is a Mexican-American scientist with a PhD in biomedical sciences who works in stem cell research. He's a cis male, bi-comfortable, lightly femme-presenting 20-something-year-old guy with who is diagnosed on the autism spectrum. He has sex with women for the most part, but has had an array of different kinds of experiences. Today, we'll be talking about sex with folks on the autism spectrum, his self-discovery through an affair with a married woman, porn addiction, and multiple male orgasms and how to have them. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. I actually don't have the PhD yet.
So oh, you're working.
Hopefully, I'm working on it.
Yeah. You're mid-PhD?
I have to submit in October my thesis.
So oh my gosh.
I'm getting there. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Keep my fingers crossed. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So to start, why don't you walk us through a little bit of kind of what your chosen labels or lack of labels are.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I am an autistic adult. I got my diagnosis about a year ago now.
Congratulations.
I was sort of started to discover that a little bit before then, but not too much. The folks who are autistic have a tendency to have issues socializing with others, but there's also a lot of nuance with how we feel comfortable and what our identity is within the whole construct of neurotypical or normal society. And so I've always felt very much not comfortable with groups of men or just behaving like a man in mm-hmm. general. Mm-hmm. I've always been sort of more on the hyper emotional, caring, sort of very hyper empathetic almost side of things. And because of that, I've never really felt like very masculine or hyper masculine. I did at some point when I was in college decide that I wanted to connect with women because I'm very attracted to women. And I was not having sex. And a lot of that had to do with my own issues with interacting in social circles and really not wanting to be at parties unless I had a lot of alcohol in me because I couldn't deal with the sensory stimuli. And at that point, when I started to behave very much in the way that I thought I was supposed to, in the way that porn had taught me to, and other media had taught me to from when I was 13, I started to behave in a certain way that I was very uncomfortable with. And so when I discovered that I was hurting myself, that I was hurting others, and that I really was behaving in a way that wasn't fully where I was, I definitely took back that. And all of my role models are very strong, beautiful, powerful women, both in my family and outside of my family. Mm-hmm. And so while I feel very comfortable in my body as a man, and so therefore don't necessarily identify as trans, and also am very attracted to men, but don't necessarily act upon that or am sexually active with men as much as I am with women. Mm-hmm. I do feel very comfortable in female spaces, so I love having girls' night with my girls and having us paint our nails and, you know, just talking about guys in general. I have a huge crush on Anthony from Queer Eye, you know, talking to my girls about those sort of topics is something I feel very comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Yeah, I guess I am cis and I am hetero-ish to some degree. Yeah. By comfortable was the word I used in one of my pieces, because I'm done with the curious part. I've done my exploration.
Sure.
But yeah, so I feel very much. I mean, if you ask my friends, if you ask my closest people, they look at me and they go, "You're definitely a woman." You know, you're more, or at least the way I act, the way I behave is very much like a woman. In my last relationship, my ex-girlfriend very much played the role of the stereotypical man, the traditional man. Mm-hmm. And I played the role of the traditional stereotypical woman. In the current relationship that I'm in, I think we are both very female in the way that we act. And so it's just, you know, it's very interesting for me to explore that within the context of identity and labels, because people want those, but I really don't know that I fit into any of the traditional letters on the, you know, LGBTQ a salad of letters. So right, I don't know, gender fluid, maybe, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome. Have you had conversations about masculinity with other men?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I have a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot, but I've got some very key male friends in my life who I am very close with, but I'm close with them individually. So whenever they're around other guys, I'm not necessarily hanging out with them as much or feeling as comfortable. And we don't talk about masculinity as much. I do some work on toxic masculinity online, and I have groups there. Mm-hmm. But within my friends, other than one of my younger cousins, who I'm very, 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 very close to, mm-hmm. I don't really talk about masculinity or emotions or how it is. And so there is a part of me that wonders, you know, do I not feel masculine because I reject the idea that society is presenting to me of masculinity? Or is it really that I am more feminine, you know, in nature and in presentation and in identity? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of some of the things that I play around with. And I think being autistic also plays into that, because there is a certain level of divergence from the norm. So even, you know, even within the misfits or the differences, people who aren't necessarily quote unquote normal, there is a part of me that just really doesn't feel like it fits anywhere, really.
Sure.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about your journey to kind of understanding who you are and how these different pieces fit together in terms of like sex and gender.
Yeah, so I had this amazing relationship with a woman who was married, 15 years older than me, and two children. Mm-hmm. It was more of an emotional relationship. It was very, very much a powerful awakening for me. And I think up until that point, I had felt very disjointed. Like, you know, this is very common in autistic adults who get their diagnosis in later in life. They realize that they've been, you know, what's known as masking within the community. They've been putting on all these different labels or you know, masks to fit into places, but they can't really feel comfortable taking those off. And so in my mind, I'm very much in my mind all the time. I have all these little representations of who I am, right? And so there's the very sort of hyper masculine person that I put on at one point that became a part of my personality, the very creative sort of fantasy nerd, you know, quote unquote, the scientist, the spiritualist, but they all felt very disjointed. There wasn't really an integration. And after I met this woman and I fell in love with her, and we really had a powerful spiritual emotional connection, it led to me starting to realize that there were a lot of neglected aspects of me that I wasn't being true to, and that there were aspects of me that I was being very rejecting of, even though that there were parts of that I actually enjoyed or wanted to, you know, actually be. And so that was sort of what started me off on this. And really, she was the first relationship that I had where there was really any communication about sex, about what we wanted, about sort of desire, and for me, you know, spirituality is an important part of that. So how do you bring that into, you know, relationship? And that's where sort of everything started. And from there, you know, she actually said to me at one point, oh, if it weren't for your social skills, I would totally think that you're on the autism spectrum. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Uh-huh. And then I didn't think about that again for another 2-3 years. You know, I was dealing with a lot of anxiety and depression. But then when I was approached by one of my aunts who works with autistic adults in Mexico City and was recommended that I go get a diagnosis or that I start looking into this aspect of me, I was so much more able to embrace that, because the one person at the time who had seen me fully for who I was, who had seen every single aspect of me, had said this, and you know, she understood me like no one else did at
the
time.
And she made it okay.
And she made it exactly.
There was no shame associated with that questioning.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. So what was your process of getting diagnosed like, and how did that sort of shift your perception of yourself?
Yeah. So there was a lot of, self-study, at first, sort of reading a lot of resources online, connecting with a lot of autistic folk online. There's a great hashtag on Twitter called Actually Autistic. There's a lot of resources online as well. And I did a lot of reading, and it was almost like those movies where you see characters like in a fantasy world read a book and like they're reading about their lives, even though they've never like been in this fantasy world before. It really was like that, where I was reading all of these pieces about me that other people knew that I had no idea about. And then also the realization that, you know, I'm a creative writer. Some of the writing that I had been doing for my honors thesis as an undergrad was really dealing, managing, and talking about the experience of being an autistic child and then adult, without really having language to express that, and, you know, bringing that out through a creative, exactly, bringing it out as a creative process. And then from there, it was really just once I got the official diagnosis, you know, medically, it was, which I should say is also a privilege, because there are a lot of underrepresented minorities who don't present as, you know, what the official medical diagnosis normally classifies autistic adult as. And so there's a lot of misdiagnosis, underdiagnosis for a lot of adults. So having a you know, an official medical diagnosis is a privilege that I am very well aware that I have. And you know, I would like to mention that a lot of adults, because they don't have access to that official diagnosis, self-diagnose, and, you know, it's just can be just as valid in terms of their identity and how they see themselves. But, you know, being more comfortable with my hyper-empathy, you know, with my hyper-emotionality in many instances, with being ecstatically happy and in love, and then being, you know, sort of very, very down, but also being very comfortable with being down and with my negative emotions, being very comfortable and wanting to sit with that and wanting to explore that as well, in a way that a lot of people were like, that's just too intense, you know. So being comfortable with that, being comfortable with recognizing why I was burning out in my personal relationships, sexual and non-sexual, recognizing that I have hypersensitivity to sounds and always have had hypersensitivity to sounds and to smells, being much more comfortable with my stims. So, you know, growing up, I used to make all these animal noises and imitate, you know, animals left and right, and, you know, just do all these weird faces in the mirror. And I stopped doing that for a really long time, and that increased my anxiety levels. And then really getting comfortable with, okay, I'm in the house and sometimes I'm going to screech or I'm going to squeal, and my housemates might think it's a little bit weird. But, you know, now that they know that I'm on the spectrum, and now that I know there's a reason and a sort of a calming, you know, stimulus that it provides, I can do that and feel more comfortable with myself. And so that's just, you know, led to, and with relationships and with sex, you know, my hypersensitivity to smells and to touch were something that was getting in the way, not getting in the way, but were leading to some maybe interesting sexual encounters and interactions that I didn't necessarily know how to process. But after my diagnosis, I was, you know, better equipped to deal with.
Sure. Can you give me some examples of how those different stims were popping up in your sex life?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we mentioned off air briefly, I told you, being hypersensitive to smells means that I get very overwhelmed in like candle shops or perfume stores. But it also means for me, at least, you know, as an individual, that I have you know, I am really interested in smells that some people might find off-putting. So there's certain armpit smells and certain foot smells that I find really, really intensely stimulating. Mm-hmm. And not in a sexual way. I mean, really, it's not like it's a fetish or it's something that turns me on. It's really just, this is a really interesting smell. I want to just sit here and smell this for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I was having an encounter once with a woman who hadn't worn deodorant, and it was the first time we were together, and I just could not keep my nose out of her armpit. And, cool. You know, she was a little bit, you know, taken aback by that and was wondering what was going on. I had already come out to her as being autistic, and so there was, you know, going forward and talking about that. Right. But sometimes I'll sit in my family living room, you know, we're sitting with my family, and I'll be like, I just really want to smell someone's feet. Can I smell your feet, you know? And my family is like, before it was like, oh, he's just being funny or he's just joking. Now I can be like, no, I actually just really want to smell your feet.
Do they let you?
Sometimes they do. Yeah. I have one sister who does let me. Cool. Everyone else is a little bit weirded out by it, and there is some resistance. Mm-hmm.
But to be able to talk about it in a way that that is within a framework that they can understand.
Right, right. And I can always smell my own feet. So
true. Yes, flexibility is very important.
Yes, exactly.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So how did your diagnosis kind of change the way that you were approaching sex?
Well, I think it changed the way that I approached relationships in general, and that, you know, affected the sex as well. Mm-hmm. And as I'm, you know, there's, as always, you know, the caveat is that I speak only for myself, you know, not all autistic folk. And, you know, there are people who are autistic who are asexual, some mm-hmm. are romantically asexual, some are aromantically asexual, and, you know, it runs the gamut. You know, everyone who's not autistic, you know, who has any combination of gender and or sexual preferences can also be found, you know, right. on the autism spectrum. So for me, at least, you know, what that meant in my own relationships is that I was, and I'm still learning and I'm getting more used to it, better able to set boundaries. So, for example, I get really burned out if I am sleeping in someone else's bed or if someone is sleeping in my own bed. Mm-hmm. And with past partners, not only was I unable to recognize that, or I recognized it, but I didn't want to voice it for fear of, well, I want to be with my partner. I don't want them to feel excluded, but I also don't want to feel excluded, right? And so it would just lead to huge burnout. So now there's boundaries. It's like, you can come over, we can have a great time, we really enjoy each other's presence, we cuddle, we do the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we both sleep in, you know, our own beds, and we sleep very well, you know, and we're recharged and ready to go. Also with social, you know, things, my ex used to love, she still does love to go to parties and hang out with her friends and be very, very social. I can't do that. It burns me out. Right. You know, even though I'm an extrovert, parties and, you know, just the way happy hours, bars,
too much stimulus all at once.
Exactly. It's just overstimulating. And so for me, that just meant, okay, I recognize now that for me, probably the best way to meet people to date is online. Mm-hmm. And I can be very upfront about what it is that I want in a relationship, which for me was a very, you know, connected spiritual relationship that we could then bring, you know, to our sex life and really explore. And it's, you know, been great since then. So the diagnosis really did change a lot of that.
Yeah. Well, and how great to have access to tools like online dating that allow you to kind of have these boundaries and be upfront about what you need.
Exactly.
So what's your approach to online dating? What do you use? What do you tell people? How do those conversations go?
Yeah. So I'm on, I'm not online dating right now cause I have a girlfriend and mm-hmm. We're really, really having a great time in our relationship. But I actually met her through an app called Meet Mindful.
Meet Mindful,
yeah.
Cool.
And it is a paid app, but I used it to meet the last three women that I dated, and they were all great and amazing. And I still am friends with the other two that I'm not with.
Cool.
And it really is just being...
And Meet Mindful is a dating app for people who are interested in mindfulness, yoga, spirituality, that sort of thing,
exactly.
Right?
People who want a little bit more connection and depth and vulnerability to their relationships.
Cool.
And so that's what I use. I try to be very honest. Because I'm very honest, I had a really, 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 really big profile. And I then asked some of my girlfriends to look at it, and they were like, okay, we're going to cut this, you know.
Tighten up a little.
Exactly. So that's my... my approach, being really open and honest and not getting, you know, taken aback by ghosting and all these other things that we've also developed with online dating. Exactly. So yeah.
How do you find the conversations about your autism go with your partners or prospective partners?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first woman that I dated, this was, you know, briefly after my diagnosis, I think I opened up to her maybe about 3 dates in or 4 dates in. I was like, look, you know, this is something I'm still processing. I'm still learning about myself and I'm still discovering, but I want to be upfront with you and tell you. And she was super cool, about it. I think it's, you know, such, a common thing for people to, you know, for autistic folk to be diagnosed nowadays, whether it's early or later in life, because there's just so much more awareness, mm-hmm. That someone either knows someone or knows someone who knows someone. Mm-hmm. And that can be not the best way, because they're like, oh, I know all about it. And you're like, well, actually, not really. But no, they've all been great. You know, they've been very open with my current girlfriend. I actually, you know, got to talking to her. I have no social filter. So if I've met you the first time, I'm going to reveal to you my personal life without thinking twice about it. That mm-hmm. was one of the things that was, you know, sometimes seen as a little bit strange. And with my current girlfriend, I told her about me being autistic on our first date. And, you know, she was super open about it. We talked about it. And yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that, like with anything else that defines you or that, you know, has to do with who you are and what it is that you need to have other people know or understand about you to be your perfect self in relationship with them. I've become a lot more comfortable talking about it and just being upfront about it. Yeah.
Do you have any tips for folks who are entering into relationships with folks who are diagnosed on the spectrum about, like, not only the social stuff, but also like the physicality of how to navigate sex?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say first thing, don't, there's a very big tendency to say, oh, but you can never tell. You don't look autistic or you don't act autistic or you
I'm rolling my eyes so hard.
I know, exactly. It's so that level of normalization a lot of times is done in good faith or trying to get people to realize, oh, but I love you or accept you just the way you are. Don't do it, because it really is not normalizing, but erasing of their experience and who they are. Mm-hmm. So really just be open, you know, to them and feel free to ask questions, especially if you're in a relationship with them. So like with any other relationship, you know, how would you like me to refer to you? Are you a person with autism or an autistic person? Most self-advocates prefer autistic rather than person with autism, mm-hmm. But they might prefer something else. So, you know, ask.
Right. Because it's part of their identity and who they are. And exactly. It's kind of the lens through which they experience the world.
Exactly. And then, you know, when in sex in particular, just be more mindful that what to you might seem, you know, just a kiss on their stomach or rubbing your fingers on their nipple or to them might be the most intense sensation they've ever felt. I mean, that was one of the issues that I was having in bed with my partners was, you know, from my nipples down to like maybe about my belly button, mm-hmm. I'm incredibly sensitive. Mm-hmm. And I've never liked massages. I've never liked oily things on me. I've never liked being touched. And a lot of times my partners thought it was just because I wasn't interested in them or because, you know, just be open, ask, you know, like always, consent is so huge. Ask, you know, I would love to give you a massage. Would you be open for it? Yeah. You know, feel free to say no if you don't want to. Mm-hmm. And then they can say, well, actually, I'm very sensitive. I don't like massages. I don't like being touched this way, or I don't like smelling these things. Can you not put perfume or cologne on? Mm-hmm. So just be very aware that a lot of things that to you might be what you think you need to do in order to be attracted or for your partner to be attracted to you doesn't necessarily fly with people who are autistic.
Right.
And that asking is a huge first step.
Well, and I think that's a great learning for anyone with any partner, whether they're on the spectrum or not. Right.
Absolutely.
I'm a super taster and I am really very smell sensitive. So like I do ask my partners not to put on cologne or perfume.
Right.
And any person with a body probably likes to be asked how they like exactly. that body to be touched.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly,
like,
yeah.
There are lots of people, you know, men, especially men I've found, who have really sensitive nipples
mm-hmm.
or who don't like their rib cages touched in a certain way.
Exactly.
So, you know, navigating those conversations, kind of no matter what their perspective is, it's really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was interesting. I was talking to my boyfriend about the fact that you were coming on the show today, because, you know, we live together and he listens to all the episodes very sweetly. And he shared an experience he had sleeping with someone who was diagnosed as autistic. And I asked him to kind of walk me through mm-hmm. that experience. And he said that it was somebody he'd been friends with for a really long time, and they went back to her place, and you know, he sort of leaned in to kiss her, and he'd actually didn't know that she was mm-hmm. that she was diagnosed. And she said, "Oh, would you like to kiss me?"
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, "Yes, I would."
Yeah.
Would that be okay? And she said, yeah. "Yes, that would be okay." And then yeah. they kissed. You know, so and that's that same level of like kind of feedback and consent happened at every single stage.
Right, absolutely. And that's the other level of it as well that I'm glad you brought up that I hadn't mentioned, is there is a lot of us have trouble reading body language or facial expressions or social cues. Some of us learn to read them, but on a cognitive basis, whereas some people won't have to be thinking about it. Others actively have to say, okay, they're smiling, or they're leaning this way, or they're moving. It must be because they want this, or it must mm-hmm. be because of
if that. If this, then that.
Exactly.
If he's leaning in and smiling, he must
exactly,
want to kiss me.
Exactly. And it becomes very mathematical. And so, I mean, for me, there is a lot of times when, you know, asking, I've had times when I've been on dates, I've really thought that someone was into me, and it turns out we were just hanging out and going to lunch. And other times where I've had a woman, you know, I was like, okay, I'll walk you home. And, you know, afterwards I'm on my bike, and she literally had to like pull me in and kiss me for me to realize, oh, this is someone who's interested in me. It was completely going over my head. I didn't realize that.
Well, and I think like with folks who are on the spectrum, like it's much more cute. But for any person, like having that level of uncertainty is part of why like dating is kind of freaky,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like
exactly.
You're hanging out with somebody who you don't know, whose cues you don't know, right?
Exactly.
Like whose facial expressions you're unfamiliar with. And so it's, you know, great to hear from someone with your perspective about how to navigate those conversations, where even if you're not with somebody who's on the spectrum, they can be applied.
Exactly. Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, it all boils down to communication, right? And for me, I might not have some of those social niceties that mean, oh, maybe I shouldn't say this, or maybe I shouldn't say that. So everything is going to come out, and I'm going to be 100% upfront, and I have a lot of trouble lying, so I'm always going to be honest, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like with anyone you're with, whether they're autistic or not, communication and honesty are key to any relationship, whether it's a one-night stand or whether it's a long-term, you know, monogamous relationship.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right, totally. We're going to go to break really quickly. Yeah, and when we kind of come back, we're going to talk about porn addiction and overcoming that.
Yeah, awesome.
You're listening to Insert Here.
Music on this program is produced by P. Morris, producer based out of LA from DC. Find his music online, soundcloud.com/P. Morris. We'll be right back on Insert Here.
Welcome back. You are listening to Insert Here, a sex podcast where lust and learning meet. Our guest today is Juan Pablo Ruiz, who is here. And before the break, we were talking about sex with folks on the autism spectrum. And now I'd like to jump in and talk about porn addiction.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you started watching porn when you were 13.
I did, yeah. So I was introduced to it, as I think most guys are. I mean, for me, it was my cousin. I'm sure for other people, it's friends and whatever, cousins, family members, Boy Scouts, whatever it is. It was a level of porn that was very much sort of on the softcore side of things.
Mm-hmm.
But like with anything, you know, the older I got, and at around the time, actually, was when I started masturbating as well. Actually, had to be taught that as well, because I had no idea. Or mm-hmm. Anyway,
who taught you how to masturbate? Do you mind me
asking?
Well,
it was my cousin, actually.
Oh, okay.
He was like, and it's not that he taught me, like, and actually he's a younger cousin. He was like, this is what you do. Here's a picture. Go in the bathroom and do it. And, you know, it was very much a like, well, it was a very underwhelming experience my first time. But there was some sort of promise for something more. And so I started, watching porn at a very young age, actually, and you know, growing up in a background that was very Catholic and very much conservative, and the idea of, you know, sex education is abstinence only type of education.
Oh, yeah.
I really wasn't prepared for sex, and you know, once I started to upgrade to more hardcore porn, which is, you know, unfortunately what's most accessible and what's most free for children underage who shouldn't really be watching any kind of porn, you know, legally, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But also because, you know, that's when we're developing our ideas about what is and isn't, you know, we're experimenting, we're trying to figure out what really is sex. You know, I didn't lose my virginity until I was 20. So I was, you know, quote unquote, a late bloomer for American standards. For Mexican standards, I was an early bloomer in that I was having sex before I was married, you know, or Roman Catholic standards. So, but anyway, the issue was that, you know, that was 7 years of really watching, very derogatory porn, very toxically masculine porn, porn that presented women with bodies that are not the way most women, you know, look. And it became addicting at one point, and it was a problem. When mm-hmm. I was in college, it got to the point where I was engaging in very unsafe behavior, online, engaging with individuals who I didn't really know, exchanging pictures. My face was in some of those pictures. God knows where those pictures are now. And really all to get this high off the porn, really more than the masturbation. It almost became flipped in that the masturbation was a means to the porn and not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I had at times jokingly with my friends said, okay, we're going to do NoFap November, or, you know, whatever it was, we're going to try to go through a month without, you know, jerking off or watching porn. But really I had no strong male influence in my life to tell me, A, this is not how sex works. You know, B, you have an addiction and that it's a problem. You need to work on that. But also C, you can separate masturbation and pornography, right? You can have some, external stimulation at the beginning, perhaps, or you can have some other way to stimulate that interaction. And then you can have very, very satisfactory masturbation, which is a normal thing for everyone to do and healthy. And, you know, mm-hmm. because of the Catholic guilt and shame, I was just so overwhelmed.
Real.
Exactly.
So
it's
real.
So real that I really had no one to talk to other than the priest at confession, who would always tell me, you know, 10 Hail Marys, no more porn, and you're good to go, which, you know, was never really effective. I really never had a strong male influence sit down with me and give me a real heart-to-heart talk about it. It wasn't until a couple of years ago when I realized that it was a problem, when I realized all of these sort of really toxic behaviors that I had picked up on that and that I was now engaging in, mm-hmm. That I really decided that I wanted to stop. And so I never went specifically to a program. I downloaded an app called Nomo, which is for any kind of addiction, mm-hmm. For those out there interested.
Cool.
It's basically a chip. It gives you your chips at different days.
Oh, cool.
And I wanted to make it special, and I wanted to hold myself accountable. So I said, I keep saying and I keep repeating, I would have loved an older male, you know, influence to speak to me about these issues. And so I decided to talk to my younger cousin about this. And I told him, this is a problem that I have. I really want you to know the risks of this. And I need your help also. I want you to keep me accountable.
Yeah.
So he was sort of my quote unquote sponsor on this app. And just knowing that, you know, really helped me taper off and, you know, not watch it anymore. I still have to say, I mean, I occasionally will still watch porn.
Sure.
But it's no longer to the degree that it is an overwhelming addiction. And I think because I'm aware that it can be addictive for me, mm-hmm. I'm a little bit more selective in what it is that I watch.
Right.
But also when I feel myself slipping, I need to stop myself and, you know, take a deep breath and go, okay, this is where we're headed, so time to move on to something else or try to seek help if I need it. Mm-hmm. So
well, and it's interesting because there is a lot of ethical porn being made now.
Yeah,
that's really cool, including like ethical porn that's being made with folks on the spectrum.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had no idea that this existed until I listened to your podcast and I went and I checked it out.
What did you think?
Yeah. My first interesting thing was like, it's like, oh, of course it makes sense that I have to pay for it. It's ethical, and mm-hmm. you know, it's something
that's
kind
that of I part of to... what makes it ethical.
Exactly. That's the point. And I was like,
paying for your wages.
Yeah, I really had a point where I was like, it's just so easy to not pay for something and then go online and watch something else. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But then looking through the you know, the videos that were available, I felt such a sense of loss because, you know, it wasn't in terms of porn. And again, this is where I weirdly separate, you know, a relationship with my partner mm-hmm. where I see them fully and I'm really turned on by being with them for the person that they are.
Right.
But porn sort of is in another part of my brain. And I actually wasn't turned on by the porn that I was looking at that was, you know, sort of feminist and ethical because it wasn't presenting to me these, you know, over, you know, amplified bodies that I got so used to seeing on a screen.
Oh, interesting.
What I did that time actually was I went onto the written word, which I've always used. You know, I have a huge imagination, and so there's a lot of sites out there that, you know, have stories on there, and that worked better for me.
Cool.
And in that case, you know, it's people submitting stuff that they're writing and that they're freely. Submitting. So
well, and that's a great ethical alternative to mainstream porn.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, not to say that there isn't mainstream porn that's ethically made, or to like be derogatory toward the folks who make mainstream porn. But just to acknowledge that like the imagery that's portrayed there
it
isn't always indicative or representative of like the full kind of spectrum of human appearance or behavior.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So we're almost out of time.
Yeah.
But I do want to touch really quickly about multiple male orgasms.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you give us a 101 for multiple male orgasms?
Yes. So I'm not an expert. I'm merely someone who practices, but the same woman that I had a relationship with, she sent me a book called The Multi-Orgasmic Couple, which then led me to The Multi-Orgasmic Man. They're sort of a paired book.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of the Tantra tradition, which comes from, if I remember my history correctly, from India. And then this book that I read is from the Taoist tradition.
Okay.
So there is a spiritual aspect to it. If you're someone like me who meditates, who's used to feeling energy through their body and who brings that to sex, it can really enhance, you know, your sort of sex life.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessary to be multi-orgasmic, and it's not necessary to be non-ejaculatory in your orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what it is you have to do a lot of Kegels, which are usually marketed towards women, and not many men know that they can as well. So you've got this muscle that goes around your prostate, and it's the same muscle that you use when you're peeing and when you want to stop yourself from peeing. And it's the same muscle that apparently this is a guy thing, but you know, the towel trick where you've got like a towel on the tip of your hard on and you're like lifting it up and down and you're doing like weights. That's the same exact muscle. Yeah. So like any muscle, you can exercise it. And
great.
You can do that when you have a hard on or when you don't have a hard on.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest way, if you're not familiar with how it feels like, is when you're peeing try to stop yourself from peeing. It's going to feel really uncomfortable the first couple of times you do it. It's not harmful. It's not going to hurt you. If something is hurting, go see a doctor. There might be an infection there that you might want to get checked out. You practice this enough times, and then when you're masturbating with yourself is the easiest time to practice it, because with partners, things tend to get hot and heavy really quickly. Mm-hmm. But practicing your breathing is very important, because that does control to some level how quickly you excite your physical body. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, when you feel yourself about to come, really it's getting in touch with your body, so that when you feel yourself about to go over the edge, you squeeze this PC muscle very hard, and therefore your prostate, which feels even better because you're stimulating your prostate, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But you stop the flow of the ejaculate through your penis. And then that means that for a lot of guys, you can keep doing this over and over again. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a limit. And, you know, depending on how over the edge you go, you can sometimes not hold it all back. Yeah. So I wouldn't recommend it as birth control, but I would say definitely something worth trying. And it feels amazing. The best orgasms I've had are non-ejaculatory ones. Mm-hmm, so,
mm-hmm. Well, and that's a great example of where, you know, bringing yourself to the edge of pleasure and kind of leaning into that, and then bring yourself back a little bit,
right,
and then
right,
kind of
exactly.
going through that cycle can really kind of lead to really, really strong and powerful orgasms, yeah. whether you're a man or a woman.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And using your PC muscle to help you control that and act as a gatekeeper to that, you
right.
know, and to really separate that. It's great. And, you know, when men mm-hmm. have orgasms, there's a lot of throbbing and moving on that goes on. And that feels great for your partners as well. Mm-hmm. So,
yep, totally. Totally.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great for all parties.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much for the 101
yeah,
and for coming on the show and sharing your perspective.
Yeah, thanks.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
You've been listening to Insert Here. We are happy to welcome guests of all different gender orientation identities and many different perspectives and experiences. So if you or someone you know might be a good guest, you can reach out to us at insertherepodcast@gmail.com. And we are always welcome to all different kinds of folks. You can find us online to listen to more episodes on iTunes by searching Insert Here, or online at insertherefullserviceradio.org. Stay horny.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.